First reading for this morning is from Revelation 6, which can be found on page 1237. So page 1237, Revelation chapter 6. I watched as the Lamb opened the first of the seven seals. Then I heard one of the four living creatures say in a voice like thunder, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest. When the Lamb opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come." Then another horse came out, a fiery red one. Its rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make men slay each other. To him was given a large sword. When the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a black horse. Its rider was holding a pair of scales in his hand. Then I heard what sounded like a voice among the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a day's wages, and three quarts of barley for a day's wages, and do not damage the oil and the wine." When the Lamb opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a pale horse. Its rider was named Death, and Hades was following close behind him. They were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and the testimony they had maintained. They called out in a loud voice, "How long, Sovereign Lord, holy and true, until you judge the inhabitants of the earth and avenge our blood?" Then each of them was given a white robe, and they were told to wait a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and brothers, who were to be killed as they had been, was completed. I watched as he opened the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. The sun turned black like sackcloth, made of goat hair. The whole moon turned blood red, and the stars in the sky fell to earth as late figs drop from a fig tree when shaken by a strong wind. The sky receded like a scroll rolling up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. Then the kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, and every slave and every free man hid in caves and among the rocks of the mountains. They called to the mountains and the rocks, "Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand?"
The next reading is Revelation chapter 7. That's page 1238. Revelation chapter 7, page 1238. We're going to read right through to chapter 8, verse 1. "After this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth to prevent any wind from blowing on the land or on the sea or on any tree. Then I saw another angel coming up from the east, having the seal of the living God. He called out in a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power to harm the land and the sea, 'Do not harm the land or the sea or the trees until we put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of our God.' Then I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel. From the tribe of Judah, 12,000 were sealed. From the tribe of Reuben, 12,000. From the tribe of Gad, 12,000. From the tribe of Asher, 12,000. From the tribe of Naphtali, 12,000. From the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000. From the tribe of Simeon, 12,000. From the tribe of Levi, 12,000. From the tribe of Issachar, 12,000. From the tribe of Zebulun, 12,000. From the tribe of Joseph, 12,000. From the tribe of Benjamin, 12,000. After this, I looked, And there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and in front of the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands. And they cried out in a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God, who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." All the angels were standing round the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures. They fell down on their faces before the throne and worshipped God, saying, "Amen. Praise and glory and wisdom and thanks and honor and power and strength be to our God forever and ever. Amen." Then one of the elders asked me, "These in white robes, who are they? And where did they come from?" I answered, "Sir, you know." And he said, "These are they who have come out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will spread his tent over them. Never again will they hunger. Never again will they thirst. The sun will not beat upon them, nor any scorching heat, for the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes." When he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour.
Well, I'm very aware that there is a danger that this morning's sermon could sound like one of those half-read holiday novels. You know the kind of book? You fall asleep once too often in your deck chair, and before you know it, you have arrived back at your front door with this novel in your case, and it's only half-read. You come back to it in December, and you think to yourself, what on earth was that all about? Well, if you are new at St. Helens or recently returned from holiday, let me remind you that we spent 11 weeks looking at the first five chapters of Revelation back in the spring. And we're rejoining the book now and intend to finish it off this autumn. So lest it be a half-finished holiday novel, let me remind you of the purpose of this book. It's designed to keep Christians trusting in Jesus in all times and in all places as it shows them his final victory. It's specifically designed to keep Christians trusting in Jesus in the face of suffering and opposition which they will inevitably face. Now, we ended our last look at the book in chapter 5 with John having a vision of Jesus about to open a scroll sealed with seven seals. This morning we're going to focus on the opening of those seals in chapters 6 and 7 that we heard read. Now, before we do that, it's worth saying how the book of Revelation unfolds from here on in. The book of Revelation from chapter 6 is a little bit like a video on rewind. It'll be the same video up until the end of the book. We will find ourselves reaching the end of it this morning. Next week, the video will be rewound, and we will move through it again. And that will happen on a number of occasions. But each time, the video, even though it covers the same time span, the same material, will focus in to give us a little bit more detail in one area or another. So the seven seals that we see this morning is the basic plot of the whole of Revelation from here on in. We're given a description of the present state of history and the experience of Christians within it. Then we're given a description of the coming judgment, and finally a vision of what lies beyond that judgment. And that will be replayed a number of times now as we move through the book over the coming months. Now, because there will be attention to detail, hopefully we won't get bored of hearing it. Well, let's look then at chapters 6 and 7. And to run with the idea that I've already introduced, it's helpful to think about these chapters as a film. They're highly visual chapters. You have to have your imagination in top gear if you are going to grasp all that is going on in them. And they're broken down into various scenes, and oftentimes we will find flashbacks happening so that there isn't just an ongoing linear narrative. We're being taken back and forth to see things from different perspectives, past, present, and future. Now, we've grown used to, in Revelation, the use of the number 7 as a device to show completeness, and that's true here. We're about to see God's purposes for his world from beginning to end, complete in all their fullness. Well, let's look then at the first scene in verses 1 to 8 of chapter 6, and I've called this scene the horrors of the horsemen. The horrors of the horsemen. This scene covers the opening of the first four seals, and it's become one of the most famous, compelling images in Western culture. Even if you've never read Revelation 6, you've probably heard of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, beloved by artists and heavy metal guitarists, it seems. The four horsemen of the apocalypse. Now, there's a certain amount of overlap among the horses. But basically, horse one is bent on conquering the earth. Can you see in verse 2? He was given a crown and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest. Horse 2 is to stir up war among people. Can you see it in verse 4? Its rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make men slay each other. Horse 3, it seems, is asked to create economic hardship. Look at verse 6. A quart of wheat for a day's wages and 3 quarts of barley for a day's wages. We're told, apparently, that's 8 to 16 times the going rate in the Roman Empire at that time. And then, finally, in horse 4, is to bring death wherever he goes by whatever means necessary. Can you see it there in verse 8? They were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth. Now the question is, when will this happen? When will it happen? Well, it sounds very much, doesn't it, like the common experience of humanity in most ages. War, hardship, and death, it seems, are ever-present realities wherever we place ourselves and wherever we find ourselves in the history of the world. For my summer holidays, I went to Belgium. We were up in the northern part of Belgium, in Flanders. And probably, for me, one of the best days of the holiday wasn't spent lying on a beach, funnily enough. It was spent exploring the Western Front of the First World War. And we found ourselves in Ypres, and in the heart of Ypres there is an extraordinary museum which recounts the events of 1914 to 18 in Flanders. And there were some extraordinary quotations from some of the soldiers who had lived through that experience. And this was one which struck me powerfully, a private who had fought at Paschendaele in Flanders. There was not a sign of life of any sort, not a tree, save for a few dead stumps which looked strange in the moonlight, not a bird, not even a rat or a blade of grass. Death was written large everywhere. Whether it had been farms, there was not a stick or stone to show. You only knew them because they were marked on the map. The earth had been churned and re-churned. It was simply a soft, sloppy mess into which you sank up to the neck if you slipped from the duckboard tracks. It is not possible to set down the things that could be written of Paschendaele. They would haunt your dreams. And the final room of the museum was a video. And written above the video was the amount of armed conflicts that the Red Cross had been involved in since 1918. It was about 120. And the video was a rolling tape of the names of those places. The Great War was called the War to End All Wars. And yet war rolls on as it has ever rolled on. But here's the shocking and the comforting thing about the four horsemen. They are summoned by Jesus Christ and are under his control. Can you see that? Verses 1, 3, 5 and 7 of chapter 6. The Lamb opens the seal. Again, in those same verses, 1, 3, 5 and 7, the horsemen are summoned with the word come from the living creatures, who we know from chapter 4 live around the throne of God. They do his will. Notice too that any power the horsemen have is given to them and is regulated by the creatures. For example, in verse 2, the horseman was given a crown. In verse 4, its rider was given power. In verse 6, they are told, do not damage the oil and the wine. They're limited in their power. And then again, in verse 8, they were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill. It's regulated. Now, isn't that fascinating? That these horrors, which seem to be the common experience of human beings at all times and in all places, are under the control of God and are even the way in which he executes his will to judge his world and to purify his people. Now, it's interesting, too, that Revelation doesn't go off into a philosophical explanation about the relationship between God and evil. That is necessary, and it happens in other places. But Revelation is designed to captivate our imaginations. It looks evil in the eye, with all its horror, with all its terror, but it reassures us that it is God's evil. Not that God is the origin of evil, or that God creates evil, but that God is so sovereignly powerful that even evil itself is subject to his rule and command. Now, that's difficult, isn't it, for us to take in? And I'm not sure how it works through in all its details. But it does bring comfort to us as Christians who experience and live through many of these horrors. God hasn't abandoned us. God is in control. The devil is God's devil. He belongs to him and is used by him to further God's glorious purposes of judgment and salvation. It is God who ultimately holds the reins of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Well, let's move on to the second scene in verses 9 to 11 of chapter 6. And I've called this scene the Cry of the Martyrs. As the fifth seal is opened, the camera pans away from the activity of the horsemen on the earth. And we find ourselves in verse 9 under the heavenly altar in the presence of Christians who have been on the receiving end of the activity of the horsemen. They've been killed for following Jesus. That seems to be the implication of verse 9, doesn't it? I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and the testimony they had maintained. Now, there are reasons to believe, and we haven't got time to get into them this morning, that this is a wider group of people than just those who have been put to death, say, in a Roman amphitheatre for following Jesus. It could refer to all Christians who have suffered all that has been going on in the world. Now, the vision blows away any idea that they are in some semi-comatose state waiting to be woken up by the final trumpet. They are shouting at God. Isn't that shocking? Look at verse 10. They called out in a loud voice. Now, by any other name, that's shouting, isn't it? Calling out in a loud voice. It doesn't necessarily tell us whether it's in anger, but by any other name, it's shouting. Here they are, the martyrs, we'll call them that, shouting at God. How long? How long, Sovereign Lord, holy and true, until you judge the inhabitants of the earth and avenge our blood? This is terrible. How long are you going to let it go on? The inhabitants of the earth in Revelation is shorthand for all those who are opposed to God and his purposes. They're calling on God to judge evil and opposition to him. They want God to act. Can you see that the patient endurance that we discovered at the book of Revelation, which is the theme of the book, which is why the book is written to encourage us to patiently endure in the face of suffering, is not passive endurance. Patient endurance can mean shouting at God, how long? Sometimes when we do experience suffering in our lives, we think that the Christian way to deal with it is somehow to smile piously and to pretend that it's not there. Maybe as we look at the horrors that occur around us in the world, we think the Christian way to deal with them is to somehow withdraw into a quiet corner where they don't touch us. But the martyrs, hidden under the altar, shout at God, "How long, God? How long before you bring an end to this?" Look at the answer God gives them in verse 11. Then each of them was given a white robe, and they were told to wait a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and brothers who were to be killed, as they had been, was completed. Can you see? History again is in God's hands. The number of the martyrs is in God's hands. No one suffers or is killed for following Jesus outside of the control of God. The number will be completed in God's plan, not in the plan of Satan or his horsemen. Now, maybe you've been following the goings-on in Afghanistan over recent months. And currently, there are 25 members of a Christian aid agency in prison in Afghanistan, awaiting trial, 8 Westerners and 16 Afghanis. And there was an interesting report on BBC Online this last week from their Afghani correspondent, Kate Clark. She says this: "For those brought up in a secular world, the idea of living in poverty as an aid worker seems perfectly reasonable. But being a martyr for the faith seems medieval and utterly incomprehensible." And it does, doesn't it? Socially respectable to live in poverty if you're an aid worker, but to be a martyr for the faith seems medieval and utterly incomprehensible. Why would people do it? Why would people in Afghanistan today be prepared to go to prison, be prepared to die? Why would people, hopefully, in the UK today be prepared to go through all that the martyrs at the opening of the fifth seal have gone through? It does seem utterly incomprehensible, doesn't it? Well, the final two seals show us that it is not for nothing. Let's move on to the opening of the sixth seal in verse 12 as the scene changes again. Scene 3, the wrath of the Lamb. The wrath of the Lamb, verses 12 to 17. Our film fasts forwards to near the end. God has promised in verse 11 that he will judge. And this is what it will be like. Verses 12 to 14 give us a picture of the whole of the earth being thrown into chaos. Earthquakes, the sun turning black, the moon turning red, stars falling from the sky being rolled up, and every mountain and island removed from its place. Massive upheaval. Things cannot go on as they have been going on. And then in verse 15, John sees seven categories of people, kings, princes, generals, and so on, probably designed to say that all kinds of people will experience the final judgment of God. No one will be exempt from it because of their class or status. No one will be able to say, I was just following orders. No one will be able to say, I am so powerful that I am beyond your authority. All classes of people are terror-struck and call on the mountains and rocks to fall on them. That will be preferable to facing the wrath of the Lamb. Now, these are terrifying images, aren't they? And they are meant to be. Sometimes we can sanitize the final judgment of God. We make it neat and clinical. Maybe you've seen one of those televised court proceedings. Have you ever seen them? They're not so common over here. Sometimes you get them on Newsnight as they recreate the day's events in the Old Bailey. They appear to be daily occurrences, maybe, in the United States. You see far more dramatic presentations of court proceedings. And they're very neat and tidy, aren't they? You can imagine yourself in the dock, possibly. It wouldn't be comfortable. You were hoping that you'd keep your fingers crossed so that you'd get off, but it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to be facing that kind of judgment. On the other side of the courtroom, you may end up in a prison, which you would be deprived of most of life's basics, but you'd get by, wouldn't you? And sometimes we reduce the final judgment of God to that sort of picture. It's cold, it's clinical, but it's bearable. But the sixth seal is terrible. It is so terrible that those who are about to suffer the wrath of the Lamb call on the mountains to fall on them. And it is Jesus who executes the judgment in his wrath, his settled, righteous anger against evil. Now, this is designed to comfort suffering Christians. It's designed to give an answer to those under the altar who shout, "How long, O Lord?" It says to them, and it says to us, Jesus is not coldly indifferent to the sufferings of his people or to the march of evil. He burns with anger against both of them. Those of you who are parents, or those of you who have children known to you, who you love dearly, how would you feel if they were mistreated? Wouldn't it be right and proper to be righteously angry against those who did mistreat them? Revelation assures us that Jesus will judge. He will, in his time, come in terrible, wrath-filled judgment against them. We may shout, "How long?" The answer is, "I will come, and all evil will be destroyed." But the wrath of the Lamb is so total, so terrible, that those facing it cry out in verse 17, "Who can stand?" Can you see the way the chapter ends? Who can stand? Well, the next scene answers that for us. Scene 4, the seal of God in verses 1 to 8 of chapter 7. Now, this is a flashback. We know because the image of the four horsemen is drawn from Zechariah 6. Jot it down in your notes. We won't go there. Where the horsemen are also identified as the four spirits or winds of heaven. So can you see in verse 1, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth to prevent any wind from blowing on the land or on the sea or on any tree. So we're being put back to the point before the horsemen have been released into the world. They're being held back until, verse 3, the servants of God are sealed with the seal of God. And the number that is sealed is 144,000. And that figure probably refers to the completed number of God's people. 12 times 12 times 1,000. It's probably the great multitude that no one could count in verse 9. Who can stand then? All those who receive the seal of God. All those who are owned by God and are marked out by his seal as being genuine. From the greatest well-known Christian to the smallest, most insignificant Christian, they are protected from the wrath of the Lamb because they have received the seal of God. One of the other trips we took on our holiday, after we'd done the Flanders Field Museum in Ypres, was to drive just a few miles outside of Ypres to the biggest of the Commonwealth cemeteries. Maybe some of you have been there. It's called Tyne Cot Cemetery, just a mile or so outside of the village of Pascandala. There are 12,000 buried there, and another 35,000 commemorated on a wall of remembrance at the back of the cemetery. It's an intensely moving place to visit. And if ever you find yourself in Belgium or driving through Belgium, do make the effort to stop there. But one of the most moving things in the cemetery was probably by far the majority of the gravestones are the remains of soldiers who nobody knew who they were. And on the inscription on the tombstone is, "A soldier of the Great War, known unto God." That's all that can be said about them. Known unto God. But you see, for the Christian, that's all that needs to be said about them. About us as Christians. It doesn't matter who we were or necessarily what we achieved in this life. The significant thing is that we were known unto God. The Christian need not fear the wrath of the Lamb. His death has turned aside his wrath from them. They are the property of God, and even if they are called on to die for the sake of the Lamb, they are protected. They will be hidden under the altar. Throughout the history of the world, even as the four horsemen appear to ride freely, God's people are protected. They need not fear destruction, either at the hands of evil or at the hands of God. They will stand. But again, in verse 9, the scene shifts to after the judgment of God. We know that from verse 14. These have come out of the great tribulation. And we take that to mean all that the horsemen bring on the earth through their period of destruction. History and its successive tribulations of the people of God have ended. And we end with scene 5, the songs of heaven, in verses 9 to 17. We're introduced to a great multitude. This is no narrow ethnic grouping. This is all God's people. They are from every nation, tribe, and language. And in verse 10, they recognize that salvation belongs to God, the King, and his people. He has finally delivered them, and because of his grace and mercy. But look what he has delivered them to, verses 16 and 17. Never again will they hunger, never again will they thirst. The sun will not beat upon them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. See, that's why it's worth keeping going. It's worth keeping going because God will deliver on his promise to execute judgment on evil. But it's worth keeping going because God will deliver on his promise to his people to bring them into his presence and to remove from them everything they have suffered in this world. Heaven will be a place where there will be no more tears. And maybe this morning you are somebody who is weeping for yourself, you are weeping for your family, you are weeping for your world. God says, trust Jesus. And he will not remove those tears now, but one day he will remove those tears. You will be brought into his presence, his glorious presence, to enjoy perfect happiness, perfect joy with him forever. How do we respond? The opening of the seventh seal, verse 1 of chapter 8. God is so glorious. His purposes are so unstoppable. His promises are so great. His judgments are so terrible. His future for his people is so wonderful that the only appropriate response is silence, it seems. There is nothing left to say. Our chattering is closed down. Our questions, what will it be like? How does that all fit together? For a point at least, we're forced to silence in the face of the living God. Let's be quiet and then I'll pray. Father, help us to know when to shout how long, and help us to know when to be silent before you. Father, forgive us for reducing Jesus to somebody who we can control. And rather we ask that you would enable us by your Spirit to worship him as someone who controls all things, who will come to judge evil and will come to deliver his people. Help us to keep going. Help us to trust him. In his name. Amen.